because since this is with our last full week of the semester, so we'll try to look at a little bit, if we have time permitting, Vayigash and Vayichi today, which I see we did last year also. I guess it makes sense at the same time of year. So last year also we ended up doing Vayigash Vayichi in a combo session. So too today, we'll try to look at both together, and they're both relatively short aliyahs, but they're very packed. There's a lot in these aliyahs, so we'll see how much we can discuss. So in the beginning of Sheni, so here we're dealing with the interaction, with the exchange between Yehuda and Yosef, Yehuda representing all of the brothers, and his plea to Yosef, not knowing, of course, that he's Yosef yet, although he's very soon to find out, but his plea to the mysterious king that he should release Binyamin, and that they should be set on their way. So as part of his plea, so here the pasuk begins, the beginning of Sheni, V'haya chiroso ki ein hanar v'meis, v'horidu avadacha es sevas avdacha avinu b'yagon sha'ola. So it's going to be very depressing to our father if he finds out that we don't have Binyamin with us. And he says in the next pasuk, ki avdacha aravis hanar. So this idea, Avdecha Aravis Hanar, is a very important pasuk. And it's a very powerful idea, which is particularly relevant to us in a Choshen Mishpat year, in a Bava year, we're learning Bava Metzia. It's a Gemara in Bava Basra that makes reference to this idea in a fascinating context. That here, one would have taken this in a somewhat non-literal sense, that he's a guardian for him in the normal functional way in which you take responsibility for example, your little brother, that it's a usage in that context specifically. But this has a meaning in the context of Mamonus as well, that the word Orev would perhaps best be translated in terms of modern financial terms as a cosigner, somebody who is willing to back up a loan that somebody else takes. So Reuven borrows money from Shimon, and Levi says, I will back it up. In other words, if Reuven is unable to pay, probably this context, using examples of the Shvatim, is probably not the best way to go about it. All right, so say you have Chaim, Shmerel, and Beryl. So Chaim borrows money from Shmerel, and Chaim is not so trustworthy. Shmerel is not so confident that Chaim is going to pay him back, but Beryl is trustworthy. So Beryl comes and says that I will back up his loan, and if he doesn't pay you, you can come to me. So that's the din of Arev. And there are a couple of different kinds of Arev. So Gemara in the very end of Bava Basra, there's an Arev Stam, an Arev Kablan. Each one has slightly different rules. One of the main differences is that normally you have an Arev. So even though the Arev is supposed to be there to back up the loan, if the loan is defaulted, so that's only if the actual borrower can't pay. But it's normally not supposed to be that the lender goes directly to the Arev. If he goes to the borrower and the borrower can't pay, so then the Arev pays. But there's different kinds of Arev. Each one has its own rules. We won't go into all the details right now. But essentially the idea is that he's there to back up the loan, he's there to back up the borrower. So the Gemara asks the question over there in the end of Bava Basra, so minayin la'arev sheneshtabed, how do we know that such a thing works? It's a fascinating idea, right? That here you have somebody who doesn't borrow the money, and yet he could technically be on the hook, he could technically be obligated to pay back money that he himself did not borrow. So in order for there to be a recognized chov in Jewish law, so we need to have some type of a mechanism that has that make sense. So how did that happen? So the Gemara has a debate about this, and the Gemara, among other possibilities, the opinion of Rav Huna is this pasuk. Gemara also has other pasukim. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute as well. But Rav Huna quotes, not necessarily this pasuk actually, but the pasuk in Parshas Miketz, which connects to this idea that Yehuda says, Anochi Ervenu, that I will be the Arev for Yosef, that's the mocker for the din of Arev in the context of Mamonus, which is a fascinating idea. And there is a lot to darshan here about the way we accept responsibility for each other and the mechanism that exists for one Jew to accept upon himself the needs and the responsibility for another one. And it's a fascinating question to explore. We'll just briefly touch upon it. If you look in the Rishonim, so there are quite a few, probably five or six different theories as to what exactly is the nature of the Shibud of the Arev. And one could darshan in terms of what it says about accepting responsibility for other people. So, for example, Rashi's understanding is Gzeres HaKasuv, which again is interesting, the idea of Gzeres HaKasuv coming from this pasuk of all psukim, that it's in that context that they're an identical kind of connection. That's itself interesting. That's a question in general, by the way, why it is that Yehuda was successful when Binyamin wasn't successful. Reuven wasn't successful, and Reuven made quite an offer. Reuven offered his own two sons. So why is it that Reuven didn't show enough of a commitment and Yehuda did? And it seems clear, as the Mefarshim explained, that Yehuda's chap was his identification with Yosef, with Binyamin. Yehuda's identification with Binyamin completely, his willingness to completely throw in his lot with him, is what did it. Here, the pasuk has the language kol hayamim, and Rashi has this idea that Yehuda had said that he would be menuda, that he would be excommunicated for beis olamos, apparently olam hazeh and olam haba, if he didn't come through with Binyamin. So the whole discussion of Hashbetz notes that we don't see that he's actually treated as a menuda at this point, and he says olam hazeh, so the brothers shouldn't come within dalet amos of him. So the Tashbetz actually suggests that really the focus was not Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, but it means specifically Olam Haba, and that in Olam Hazeh it was not Menuda, that Rashi's language isn't actually precise over here. And the Chidah is a tshuva where he expresses great shock at that. He says it can't be that Rashi is not being precise. You have to figure out why they were not Nohig Chayrim with him. But presumably it means what it says, Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba as well. But in any event, either way, it represents an absolute level of identification that Yehuda was willing to throw in with Binyamin, and this perhaps serves as the mucker for the idea of Arvus, for the idea that you can accept a connection with somebody, the Yechayev, to pay back his loans. So other Rishonim have different models in terms of understanding, not necessarily it's specifically Gzeres HaKasuv. Some say that it's a Hischayvus Midas, it's the view of the Rambam. Now the Rambam's opinion is l'shitasto, because not all Rishonim agree that such a thing exists. That the idea that if somebody says, I owe you money, and there's no actual reason for the debt. He didn't borrow any money, he wasn't mazik, he didn't steal anything, and there's no claim that he did. So this is not a hodah in the context that we've been talking about, the modiv amiktsas or hodas baldin, that there isn't a claim against him, and he's not saying that he did anything that should be mechayiv him. That the whole nature of the chiyiv is because he decides to be mechayiv himself. Besides, okay, I owe you $100 for no reason. So not all the Rishonim agreed that that works. But the Rambam maintained that that is a valid type of kinyan, a valid type of creation of a chov, and you owe money for that reason. And therefore, the Arev is meshubed with that mechanism. That the Arev says, okay, this guy borrowed $100, I'll owe you $100 who doesn't pay back. Why does he owe? Because he said that this is a Rambam l'shitaso, that you have the ability to do that, which also provides an interesting model that you can connect with somebody in such a way that you can just take on their burdens just because you say so. And the Nitziv understands in his Emek Sha'Allah, that the idea that Yehuda accepted the responsibility for Binyamin was Davka, that he accepted his Averos. He says, I'll take on whatever lot he has, whatever issues he has in Olam Haba, I'll take on for myself. It somewhat parallels the way the Rambam is talking here, that I can say something and take upon somebody else's chiyuvim, somebody else's responsibilities and burdens, just because I say so. The Ritva has a particularly fascinating idea as well, that the Ritva understands that it's not totally accurate to say that the cosigner isn't receiving anything here. He is receiving something. What is he receiving? He's getting hana. What's the hana? He gets the hana that he's the trustworthy one here. He's able to come in and save the day with his credit, with his name, that his name is what makes this work. So that makes him the trustworthy one. So that's the hana. And he uses that hana as the shibud, as the kenyan. So that's also a really fascinating model of how such an idea could work. And here as well, one could argue that the mechayev of Yehuda on behalf of Binyamin was the fact that Yaakov agreed to it, the fact that Yaakov trusted him. And that could actually perhaps be a response to the question of the Panim Yafos. The Panim Yafos notes that the Pasuk says a little bit later, Pasuk Lamed Daled, Ki Eich El El Avi, V'Hanari Nenu Iti. How am I going to go back to my father and the young man is not with me? So the Panim Yafos says, well, what's the significance of that? We've already established why you have to worry about it. You have to worry about it because you're the Arif. So who cares what your father's going to say? That's a secondary problem. But the main problem is you accepted the Achrayas. So we could say that that's how he accepted the Achrayas. The fact that his father is going to be so disappointed in him, the fact that his father trusted him, that's how the Chiyuv comes about in the first place. So he's perhaps especially evoking that in this context as a part of how this Chiyuv is created. A few other interpretations in Rishonim as well. The Rush writes in Kiddushin that you essentially connect with the person so that it is as if you receive the money, together. The Rashbam, the end of Baba Basra, the Rashbam sounds as if it's a concept of shlichus, that the Arev becomes the Mishaleach and the lender becomes the Shliach. So he is therefore instructing the lender to lend the money, so he bears responsibility for it because it came about through his shlichus. These are all really fascinating concepts. And the Mukhi Yosef also brings in a really interesting notion that it's based on the concept of mazik. Essentially, if I cause somebody to lose money because he lent somebody money and now it's defaulted, so now he's out the $100 that he lent the other guy, so perhaps the whole notion of Ariv is that he can come back and claim that I'm a mazik, that if I told him to lend the money, that trust me, he's good for it, and now it turns out he's not good for it, so maybe I bear responsibility as somebody who caused him a loss, and therefore he can fix his loss by coming to the Ariv and saying, now you have to pay it, now you bear the responsibility, because I lent it on your say-so. That's the nature of the Ariv arrangement. So of course there's a lot to say about Ariv, but it's particularly fascinating, especially in light of the fact that this is not just a drash ba'alma. It is, in a sense, a drasha, but it's reflecting on the fact that the pasuk in this context is quoted by the Gemara, at least in one opinion of the Gemara, as the source for this whole concept in Hilchos Mamonos. Hi.
According to the Russian's approach, that he sort of got him into this lending deal that he might not have should have, does it serve a little bit like Lo Sachmo?
Well, it was the Nimuk Yosef.
Nimuk Yosef.
A little bit like Lo Sachmo. I don't know if it's not necessarily about that. I mean, he pressured him and made.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it's about that so much. That the guy's willing to lend money to people who were trustworthy. So he wouldn't have trusted this guy. So I told him, you can trust him. Now it turns out that if he had been trustworthy and returned the money, everything would be fine. But because he didn't return the money, so now I made a bad investment, so to speak, in this guy, or took a bad risk, and I took the bad risk because you told me to. So we don't always know that you're necessarily liable. It's an issur d'oraisa to give somebody bad advice knowingly. Presumably that's not necessarily what happens here. But if somebody knowingly gives somebody bad advice, so it's an issur d'oraisa ablefnei iver lo sitein mechshol. And yet, he's generally not going to be chayiv for that. It's going to be considered a grama. So this you need the chiddush of Arif to say that you'd be chayiv in such a case. But that's perhaps the way it works, is that the chiddush of Arif creates this type of mazik liability, that because you told the person to do it, so then you now are somebody he can come back and collect from. The Lubavitcher Rebbe has a fascinating sicha where he focuses on the fact that according to Rav Huna, Yehuda is the mocker, and according to other opinions in the Gemara, there are other sources. So he suggests, what are we saying when we say that Yehuda is the mocker? And we mentioned at the outset that it really is not in a normal monetary context. It's very interesting that we transfer it to an actual nuts and bolts kosher mishpat kind of concept. So he suggests, in machlokas in the Gemara, is that we know we say, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazem, or Zebazem. So what does that mean? Is that just a ruchnius idea? Does that just mean yatsa motzi, that I can make kiddush for somebody else if I've already made kiddush because of Kol Yisrael Arevim? Or does it transcend that realm? And does it go for all kinds of purposes? It goes into mamonos as well. So the idea that Yehuda's statement here could be used as the halachic marker for the choshen mishpat concept of arvus, and that we link the Orachayim concept of Arvus and the Choshen Mishpat concept of Arvus, means that Kol Yisrael Arevim is a transcendent concept that applies in all kinds of different areas. Then he goes on to give a drash. He says, we talk about the Achdus, and we talk about Arvus, so we mean different things on different levels. On the one hand, we mean that all the parts are there, everything is together. A higher level than that is that all the parts feel that they need each other, feel that they are interdependent. And an even higher level than that is that everyone feels as if they are all part of one entity, and that they don't have any independent goals, so to speak, or any independent functioning other than as part of one entity. And he goes on to darshan about Klal Yisrael, that there's achdus on different levels, that we can all coexist, that we can all actually feel the value of each other as a higher madrega, or that we can actually feel that we are all in a common mission. And that's the highest madrega of Arvus, and perhaps that's what we're being told here, that there is a complete transcendent notion of Arvus that brings all the concepts together. And Yehuda is the one who's best able to express that, because Yehuda is Malchus, the idea of a common king for the Jewish people is about revealing the connection that everyone has together as one entity. And then he goes on to darshan the fact that this is also, that Vayigash is always read in proximity to Asara B'Teves, that this is one of the main themes of Asara B'Teves, the reconnection of Achdus. It's interesting that he doesn't talk about this point. Rabbi Simon talks about this in his Sefer, that there is an idea, I think, of Shlomo Fischer has in his drushes, that the other Shlomo Fischer, that all of the Tanaisim that we have, we know, have a earlier event in history that's also associated with them. So Tisha B'Av is the Chorban, but before that it was Chet HaMeraglim. And Shavasu B'Tamuz, before it was Shavasu B'Tamuz, was Chet HaEgel. So what's the historical meaning from the Chumash? What's the Pentateuchal history of Asara B'Teves? So he says, he suggests, that he thinks that Asara B'Teves was the day of Mechiras Yosef. So Mechiras Yosef, that was the beginning of the Galus, and that was also then manifested later on in the Asara B'Teves associated with the Chorban. But the notion of that actual day of Asara B'Teves is when there was a siege around the city, and Bavel and the Melech Bavel Nebuchadnezzar was approaching the city. So everyone is forced inside together. So even though it represents something bad, but it also contains Hikdim Refuah L'Machla, it contains its own remedy, the idea that we're all forced together, that we're all put in the context of Achdus. So that will ultimately be the remedy for the Galus. So at the same time as the Galus is beginning, it's also indicating what its remedy is. And that's also the symbolism here of Yehuda, who's able to take on the Achdus for everyone. And that's also symbolized by the fact that he's the king. He's the one that shows that we are all connected. So there's a lot of fascinating, you could spend many hours talking about Hilchos Arvus, but just the extent to which the various models perhaps reflect various understandings in this psukim. So that's a fascinating point. And that's not the only fascinating point in this Aliyah. Again, it's a short Aliyah, but there are many, many major themes to talk about. So I have to really see if we even get up to Vayechi, focusing on just two or three of the ideas here. So if you look at the beginning of Parak Memhei over here, after Yehuda has made his plea, so the Pasuk says, V'yachal Yosef l'his hapek l'chol hanitzav m'olav, v'yikro tziyu kalish me'alav, v'omer ish ito b'yisvada Yosef alachav. So Yosef, he couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't hold it in, so he sent everybody away. What does it mean, he couldn't hold it in? It's an interesting question. Meshech Chachma says that really, Yosef wanted to play out his dreams. That Yosef wanted to have his initial dreams from Vayeshev be manifested now, have the brothers come before him, and then bring Yaakov over so that all of them, the brothers and Yaakov, as his initial dreams in Vayeshev indicated, will all come before him as a king. But he couldn't do that because, and he saw from all of, because there were other people around who would not have chapped what was going on, and it would have looked like Stam Machzarius, so it wouldn't have made any sense, and it would have looked like cruelty, so he wasn't able to do that. That's one way of looking at it, but the way it's normally understood is that he couldn't hold himself back. He had to reveal to his brothers what was going on. But there was a problem that everybody else was in the room. All of his guards, all of the Egyptians were hanging around, so he sent them out of the room. And that is a fascinating issue, because the Medrash has what seems like two opinions about that. Because according to one opinion of the Medrash, he did something very wrong. by doing that. He essentially put himself in tremendous sakana. He put himself in danger because once he got rid of his bodyguards, so he could reveal himself to his brothers, and that would save them from embarrassment. That was the other opinion in the Medrash, that he did the right thing by getting rid of all these people, because it would have embarrassed the brothers to have this whole revelation take place when these other people were around. But the flip side is, it's nice that he saved him embarrassment, but he put his life at risk. Because if he would reveal himself to the brothers and no one else was there, so the brothers could say, well, this is awkward, but luckily there's no one here to stop us, so we could kill him and we could go. Some of the should explain that they may have done that. He could have been afraid they might do that because we don't yet have any indication that they changed their mind from their original psak, right? Their original idea that they thought, we discussed in Parshas Vayeshev, that he was chayiv misa, that they were right in trying to kill him, that he had a din of erodev. So for all we know, they still feel the same way. So if he puts himself alone and says, hi, I'm Yosef the Rodev, and there's no one else there, so then it's very possible they would have killed him. So the idea that that's the case, the other opinion of the Medrash seems to say that he didn't think that was a possibility. But if it is correct that he was really in danger here, so then it seems like he was willing to put himself at risk in order to avoid embarrassing the brothers. And this is a major Bav Metzia topic. I think we alluded to it a little bit. Hopefully we'll get to see the Gemara a little bit next semester. We'll learn a little bit of Hazav. We'll see how that plays out. But the Gemara at the end of Hazav tells us about the prohibition of embarrassing people in public. And the Gemara there notes from the behavior of Tamar in Parshas Vayeshev that Tamar was put on trial for the pregnancy that Yehuda thought came from someone else. And she could have saved herself simply by identifying Yehuda as the father. And she doesn't do that. She gives him the ability to come forward. And it sounds like from the Chumash that had he not come forward on his own, so she would have not said anything. She would have let herself be executed. So that's an unbelievable idea. So the Gemara says, you see from here, Noach lo liadam shi'apil atzmo l'kivshin shaleish v'yal ben p'nei chaver b'rabim, that it's preferable for a person to let himself get thrown into a fiery furnace rather than embarrass somebody else in public. And there's a lot that's very difficult. I feel like we touched upon this recently in terms of trying to figure out, yeah, we talked, because it came up in our second parak discussion about to what extent is one allowed to embarrass somebody else as part of a judicial process. Like we mentioned, Asher Weiss has a whole essay about this. He has a very hard time understanding the whole notion of Tamar risking her life for this purpose, because it seems that if you are on trial for your life, to say that you can't exonerate yourself by identifying the actual criminal and or the actual protagonist, and that's going to involve embarrassing them, so it's very hard to believe that that's not a legitimate thing to do. And he assumes the halacha for sure is a legitimate thing to do. So to figure out how exactly Tamar came to this decision is very tricky. But the Yesod, the Gemara seems to understand from there, is that Noach lo la'odam, that it's apparently better for a person to risk his life and possibly die rather than embarrass someone in public. So that's a really astounding idea. What's it based on? So it seems like it's based on the fact that the Gemara over there compares Shvichas Damim and Halbanus Pnei Chaver Barabim, that to embarrass somebody is on some level comparable to murder. The Gemara gives a physiological clue. We call it shvichas damim, spilling blood. So somebody who's embarrassed, so their blood drains. But that's presumably not the real reason. That's just a clue. But that the real issue seems to be that the emotional pain a person goes through when he's humiliated is so profound that there are those who would prefer death. And we know that historically there are those who certainly make that decision. At least it's exists in some cultures and in most cultures, that there are people who, facing profound humiliation, would rather choose, Rahman al-Islam, rather choose suicide than go through such humiliation. So it's not off the charts, it's not out of the realm of imagination to say that actual humiliation, when it is at its most profound expression, could really be worse than death for some people, and in some settings. So perhaps based on that, one could come to the conclusion that it actually is Yehariv Val Yavor. But that's what the Gemara is saying, that it's included within Ritzicha. And Ritzicha is Yehariv Val Yavor, so too embarrassing people is as well. So is that really true la halacha? So the first thing we'll emphasize is do not try this at home. Don't think it's actually practicable, but it's interesting that the Gemara sounds like it. And whether or not the Gemara means it seems to be a machlokas harishonim. Then on the one hand, Rabbeinu Yonah says the Gemara is literal, and the Gemara means it. And the Tosfos in Masechta Sota and Daf Yud, it also sounds like that. Because Tosfos raises the question that the Gemara says in Sanhedrin and Daf Ayin Daleth, there are three Harivol Yavars. We all know, Shvichas Damim and Gilei Arayos and Avodah Zarah. So how come this isn't on the list? So the easiest answer to say would be because it's not literal. We don't really mean it. So that's why it's not on the list. But Tosfos doesn't give that answer. So the Brisker Rav and others, they assume from that Tosfos, they see that it is literal. However, the problem is that the other easiest answer to give, the second easiest answer to give, is that it is on the list. That if it's a subset of Ritzicha, so then you don't have to list it separately. So Tosfos doesn't give that answer either. So Tosfos doesn't give either of the two easiest answers. So it's hard to really peg Tosfos, and there's been some debate about what Tosfos means, but some put Tosfos in the literalist camp here. And in the other camp that says it's not literal, you have most explicitly the Meiri. This Gemara appears in a bunch of places, not just in Bav Metzia, but it's in Brachos, and Psachim, and Sota, comes up in a number of places. So the Meiri, in a bunch of those places, the Meiri says that this Gemara is not literal. It's a way of conveying just how chomer it is to embarrass people. But the debate, the Rambam is also assumed to be in that camp, because the Rambam says that anything that's not Yehar V'Yavor, so it's usher to be Moser Nefesh, you're not allowed to volunteer to be Moser Nefesh. And he doesn't list this as something you can be Moser Nefesh for, so most of the Acharonim, a few possible exceptions, but most assume that the Rambam holds it's also not literal. So it seems to be a debate among the Rishonim, and it's a little bit of an unresolved issue among the Achronim as well. The Binyan Sin has a tshuva, Bavad Yosef has a tshuva. It's a little bit of an ongoing discussion. Again, you should emphasize, do not try this at home. But it's an interesting question, why not? So once saw a discussion in one of the rabbinical journals. There was an article by what's his name? By Pinchas, forgetting his name for a second, somebody wrote an article in one of the journals where he says that he thinks the pshat is like this, and this is probably a very compelling approach, that the Gemara says, Noach lo la'adam, that it's preferable for a person to sacrifice his life rather than saying you're mechuyev to. So it's not necessarily a halachic statement as much as it is a reflection of a possible reality, that it could be that the humiliation will be so severe that it would be better to die rather than put somebody else through this. However, you can't know that going in. There's no way to predict just how something will play out in terms of humiliation. There's so many variables, and every human being is different in terms of how they react, and in terms of how everyone around them is going to react, and in terms of how long-lasting something will be. There's so many different variables that you can't know in advance that the humiliation that we're talking about is on that level. Presumably, you make such a statement, we don't mean anything embarrassing, we mean actual humiliation. Nobody would say that if somebody spills spaghetti on his pants in the cafeteria, so that's worse than death. You know, you can have a minor embarrassment, but the actual humiliation of a kind that lasts forever, so then that's perhaps a different category. So it seems to be that one could argue, and I think this is a compelling approach, that theoretically it's true. Theoretically you're right, that it makes sense to say that it could have been Yehari V'Yavor. But in practice, to actually take the step, take an irrevocable step, when you don't know that it's actually going to play out that way, so that we wouldn't ever actually tell anyone to do. And this could also explain, Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva, where he discusses some of these zinyanim. He is among the many who disagrees with the Chachma Shlomo. Shlomo Kluger has a tshuva, where he has a very extreme version of this comparison, this idea that Shvichas Damim and Habanas Panim is compared to each other. So he has a Chiddush Din, which could come out of that. He actually uses a different way to get to this conclusion, but it could be fit within the structure as well. So we know that you have a Chiyuv to save somebody else's life. You see somebody drowning in the river and you can pull them out. So you have a Chiyuv, Lo Salmid Al Damriach. But what would happen if you jump into the river, so it's likely you're going to drown. So to sacrifice your life to save somebody else's life, so that you're probably not even permitted to do. So says Reb Shlomo Kluger, you could say the same thing, that if you have to be mavazi yourself, if you have to humiliate yourself to save somebody else's life, you wouldn't be mechuyev to do it. Again, there's another. He has another way of getting to that conclusion, but it seems also that it fits within this idea of comparison between death and humiliation. So all the later poskim talked about this. They did not accept this. Did not think this was correct for various reasons. Kli Chamda talks about this. Diane Grossness from London and Tshuva Slav Aryeh talks about this. No one accepted this as correct. And Reb Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva in which he also rejects this. This is in Siman Zion, the Tshuva's Mincha Shlomo. But he has reasons for rejecting this conclusion, but it's not because he necessarily thinks the comparison isn't literal. He thinks the comparison is a pretty strong comparison. So based on that, he says he thinks he also doesn't understand why it is that if you see somebody about to be humiliated on Shabbos, and you can save them from humiliation by being Mechal Shabbos, so maybe you should do it. If you're Mechal Shabbos to save someone's life, so you should Mechal Shabbos to prevent them from humiliation as well. So why don't you say like that? So he's not sure why he doesn't say like that. He's not ready to say that that should be the din. We know it's not the din, apparently, but he's not sure why not. Now he points out that if it was a Chil Shabbos to Rabbanan, so it would be the din, because that's the whole sugya actually in the second paragraph of Mincia. We didn't have the opportunity to talk about it. Maybe we'll fit it next semester somewhere. We talked about it last year when we were learning Shabbos a little bit. That there is a whole sugya that Kavod Abrios is doch din derabbanan. So if it was a Chil Shabbos derabbanan, so then Kavod Abrios, avoiding humiliation, would actually justify it under the right circumstances. It's a whole complex discussion. But for Daraisa, so he's not ready to say that you should Mechal Shabbos for that level Daraisa to save somebody from humiliation, but he's not sure why not. There is a lesser known posek in the Tshuva Shemi Shimon. He actually has a psak. He is ready to say that you should Mechal Shabbos even on a Daraisa to save somebody from humiliation. But the Tshuva Shemi Shimon is not as influential as Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so it's not going to have the same kind of impact. But Rav Shlomo Zalman wasn't ready to go that far. But the question is, why not? So there are those who have various approaches. Why not? One could give the same answer that we just said a minute ago, except that I should remember his name. The author of the article's name is Rav Pinchas Levinson. So his approach that he used for the Yehari V'Yavar question, you could say that here as well, that theoretically it could be true. That if you really knew that the person was going to undergo a humiliation that was comparable to death, so then, yes, you should be Mechal Shabbos in order to prevent it from happening. But since we never really know how these things are going to play out, there are so many variables. So in practice, we're not going to tell you to do something irrevocable in order to prevent it. It's not good policy. But in theory, on paper, it could have been true. And maybe that's the answer to both of those in terms of a theoretical Yehari V'Yavar and a theoretical Chil Shabbos. Maybe it all comes from that.
So we would be willing to go so far as to say you can violate Shabbos Derabanan.
Because that's a Gemara. The Gemara says that Kavod Abrios is Dochei Din Derabanan. So that sugya appears at the five times in Shas also. It's a different sugya five times in Shas. The Gemara in Brachas, the Gemara in Shabbos, the Gemara in a couple other places. So that, you have to figure out when you apply and when you don't apply. It's a whole complicated thing. So it's an Elul Mitzia sugya. We didn't actually get to it. This semester we'll find a place to put it in. But theoretically, on paper, that's also true. So that should at least be true, at least within that context. Hi.
Maybe you can say, just to justify why you wouldn't be able to Mechal Shabbos to save someone from embarrassment, is because in terms of saving a life, you can be Mechal Shabbos, the Gemara I think talks about, so the person
Kalei can Shabbos
Achas. Right, you have more Shabbos. So here he's going to be able to keep Shabbos till after even his embarrassment.
Right, so there are those take approaches. There's a sefer called Siach Yosef, written by Yosef Roth. He talks about that Shaiv also, and he has an answer similar to that the nature of the Pekuach Nefesh and Shabbos has its own unique qualities that wouldn't extend here. So there are a couple ways to look at it, but it all emerges from the idea that it really is a literal comparison. There was a discussion, also Rav Osner has a tshuva, as does Nassim Gishtetner, and his tshuva is Slaharis Nassim, about a Kohen, that the Gemara says in Brachas, the end of Brachas, that a Kohen who has killed someone, Kohen Shaharigas HaNefesh, is not allowed to duchen. It's based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, your hands are filled with blood, such hands should not be used for duchening, for nesias kapayim. So a Kohen who is killed is not able to duchen. So these poskim discuss, let's say you have a Kohen who goes around embarrassing people, who's a malden p'nei chaver barabim. So maybe we should say also he's a reiseach, so we should say that he shouldn't be allowed to duchen. So is that really the case? So these two eminent poskim, Shevet Alevi and the Laharis Nassim, they both didn't think that they were ready to go so far, didn't think it was so literal. The Laharis Nassim notes that even if it was literal, so the pasuk says, Yideichem Dam Maleu, it means physical murder. So it has to, even if it was actually equivalent, it would still have to be physical with yadayim in order for it to be a psul for nesias kapayim, which involves the hands. You could perhaps suggest, though, that berachas kohanim also involves the mouth. So if somebody embarrasses and kills through the mouth, it should also have the same din. But okay, he wasn't ready to go so far. But it's also interesting, if you look in the library, look in the different shelves of the different areas of halacha, there's a shelf there of all the svarim of berachas kohanim. So in some of the svarim that are devoted to berachas kohanim, you will find those who come out and say that a kohen who embarrasses people should not be allowed to duchen, because of the comparison to shvichas dam. Again, they're not as influential as the shevet alev and the laharis nasim, but there are those who are willing to take it that far. And from a philosophical perspective, it comes up as well, this whole comparison with David HaMelech and the Gemara in Bava Metzia. At the end of the fourth parak, so the Gemara says that David HaMelech had a very hard time trying to get past the whole episode with Bathsheba, that he'd be giving a shir, and he'd talk about whatever it is, he'd say, he'd be giving a shir about any topic, and then somebody would raise his hand in the back and say, "Hi, Fred Smith, National Enquirer, King, that's a very fascinating shir you just gave on Migul Hotzi Lo Amrina. Tell me, what's the din about somebody who gets involved with a possibly married woman, a suffocatious ish?" So clearly it was not really part of his curiosity about Migul Hotzi that makes him bring this up. So he's trying to embarrass the king. So David HaMelech's response was, "That's a great question. Such a person is executed, but he has a chelek in Olam Haba. But somebody who embarrasses people in public has no chelek in Olam Haba." So you get the point. So the Gemara says from there that Noach lo adam shiyavo al safek eishes ish v'alyal b'nei chaver b'rabim, that it's preferable to get involved with a possibly married woman rather than embarrass someone in public. So that one you don't find brought l'halacha by anybody, which is maybe not so surprising because it tends not to come up that often. It's not as likely a topic for halachic analysis. But it's interesting. So this statement that David HaMelech says, "There's no chelek in Olam Haba," so where did he get that from? So you might say, well, it's the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Okay, you're correct. Where did the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos get it from? So that's a whole discussion, and the Rishonim have different theories, and it could tie into this issue. That could be L'shitasim. So we mentioned already the question of Yehari V'Yavo, the one that ties into the Parsha before we get too far astray. So the question of Yehari V'Yavo for Halbanas Pnei Chaver V'Rabim, so we mentioned before there's a question whether to take that literally or not. And it seems that Rabbeinu Yonah definitely does take it literally. And the Rambam is assumed by many of the commentaries not to take it literally. So it could be L'shitasim here, that the question of why is it that somebody who embarrasses people has no chelek in Olam Haba, as the Mishnah says in the third parak of Pirkei Avos. So why should that be? So Rabbeinu Yonah, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, so he explains why it is. He says, because he's like a murderer. He has the same din as a rotzeach. It's a literal comparison. So you might tell me that we don't find anywhere that a rotzeach has no chelek in Olam Haba. So why should that be the case here? So Rabbeinu Yonah says, you're right, he's worse than a murderer. Why? Because really a murderer should also lose his chelek in Olam Haba. But the murderer is going to realize he did something horrific. There's going to be a whole scandal, there's going to be a trial, everyone's going to make a big fuss, so he's eventually going to realize what he did, he'll do tshuva. So he would have lost his chelek in Olam Haba, except that he'll do tshuva and he'll get it back. But somebody who embarrasses somebody in public, says Rebbe Yon, it's the same thing as a Ritzayah. But he's never going to realize it. He's going to think, okay, this is my personality, this is how I talk, there's no big deal, it's fine, it's not an issue. And he's never going to do tshuva, so then he's going to be left with the same onesh of the Ritzayah as Nocher Lekin Olam Haba. That's how Rebbe Yon says, it comes out the Shitaso, the same way that there is an actual comparison to murder. So the Rambam's probably also the Shitasa, because so the Rambam took it not literally and thought that it was just a statement of the Chumras HaIsser. So the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnayos, Perish the Mishnayos in the end of Sanhedrin, where in Perich Chelek, where the Gemara and the Mishnayos tell us about who has the Chelek in Olam Haba and who doesn't. So the Rambam says that somebody who embarrasses people in public regularly and other comparable Averos, so that shows us that he's in a very specific halachic category known as a jerk. And a person who is a jerk, you can assume, is probably not a ben olam haba. Not that it's a quid pro quo that because of this one avera he gets this onesh. It's that if this is his habit, that's the Rambam phrases it, that he regularly embarrasses people in public, so then that's a good sign that he's probably not on the list. And when it comes up to Shemayim, and they're going to say who's in and who's out, it's hard to imagine that a person who does this regularly is a person who's on the list. It's a good indication that he's not a Ben Olam Haba. So the Rambam is probably Shitaso, that he doesn't understand it to have the same Chumrah as Rizicha, but he understands it to be Chumrah Avera, which if somebody does it always, if somebody does it often enough, it's an indication of a low character, of a certain type of personality that's unlikely to be a Ben Olam Haba. So all of these issues are perhaps in the background of this question, could it possibly actually be Harivol Yavor? And maybe the opinion in the Medrash that suggests that Yosef was really endangering his life by getting rid of everybody when he did this, perhaps that's a way of saying that he really felt that way as well. And the other opinion would disagree. So in any event, so he reveals himself to his brothers, and Vayitein es kolo bivchi, Vayishma Mitzrayim, Vayishma beis paro, he spoke very loudly, and he said, Vayomer Yosef elecha, Vani Yosef, Ha'od avichai, Voyochlu echa, V'anos oso ki nivholu mipana. So this is one of the greatest psukim for darshanim. The Medrash has a comment here that is so rich in material for the darshanim. There's so many beautiful divrei Torah that are different from each other, but are all very good, and that all come on this pasuk, that all reflect the Medrash. Chazal, the Gemara Maseches Chagiga says it one way, Medrash says it a little bit more powerfully, that there is massive tochacha going on here. Right? That's what the Gemara says in Chagiga, that you can just imagine the tochacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was even worse, the tochacha of Basu V'dam is so powerful. And the Medrash expresses it a little bit more evocatively. The Medrash has these statements, Oy lanu miyom hadin, oy lanu miyom hatochacha, woe is to us, the future is really scary for the day of judgment, because here Yosef was the youngest of the brothers and he was giving them mussar and they couldn't handle it, they couldn't respond, they were nivhalu, they were all shocked, they were all devastated. Imagine what it's going to be like for us in Yom Hadin. Everyone asked the question. What's the question everyone asked on this Medrash and on the Gemara as well? Where do you see any Musar? He doesn't say anything. He just says, Ani Yosef, Oda Vichai. That's Musar? Well, it fits with the statement that it's a little bit of Musar, but the idea that it's Musar at all is very hard to understand. So the Pashtus interpretation, the way that Nitzir writes in the Torah Tamima, says that he's saying, listen, how you talking? That now you know who I am and you know that I know what you have done. So is the Shaykh that our father is still alive? Could he, is a little bit of a rhetorical question, could he actually have survived being put through this all these years? And then Nitziv adds that maybe it was a genuine question, maybe it wasn't rhetorical, because even though they've been making references to the father, but they've been lying about other things. So or they've covered up the whole connection with him. So then maybe they were just pretending that he was alive in order to get sympathy. So maybe Hitaka didn't know. Maybe it's either rhetorical or a genuine question. He's saying, is it really Shaykh that our father could have endured all of this? The Babcher Rebbe comments a little bit further that maybe he's saying, I am Yosef, I'm alive. So since we know, Chazal tell us earlier in Vayesha, that Rashi quotes that you can't, that Yaakov never got comforted because you can't accept Nechama and Achai, that if somebody's really dead, so people are able to move on, but if somebody is still alive, they never actually feel Nechama. So Yosef is saying, since I am Yosef, I'm alive. So that means all these decades, he was not able to ever get Nechama. He's been suffering like crazy. The loss of a child for 20 years. Is it possible he's still alive? Is it possible that he survived such a thing? So on a Pashtus level, that's very possibly the Musar. But there are a number of other more involved Pshatim, which are all very fascinating. So for example, Rav Pam, there's a sefer of all the drushas of Rav Pam called the Tara L'Melech. A lot of beautiful things. So one of the things that he quotes is, he mentions this idea. He quotes a Beis HaLevi, which is different than a Beis HaLevi. There's a famous Beis HaLevi that we'll mention in a second also when interpreting this pasuk, but he quotes a different Beis HaLevi before we get to the Beis HaLevi on this pasuk that may be too long to go into right now, but Rav Pam's basic point is that we know the Gemara, for example, talks about somebody who saw the next world, somebody who got a glimpse of the Olam HaEmes. And his response was, and his description of the Olam HaEmes was, that Olam Hafuch Ra'isi, I see that the next world is upside down. Delionim lamata, v'tachtonim lamala, that those who are distinguished in this world and who are honored are on the bottom in that world, and those who are on the bottom in this world are held up on top in the next world. In other words, that this world is not fair. That people who really deserve good things don't get it in this world, and the people who get it, the good things, don't always deserve them. But ultimately, everything's going to be fair. So if you think about it, considering that kind of a future is very powerful Muslim. If you think that there's going to be a time in the future when you're really going to be held to the standard, do you deserve the honor and the glory that you have? It's very scary, because either it means you have to shape up quickly and live up to that honor, or that you're going to be tremendously turned upside down. It's a very scary thought. So it's a very powerful, motivating idea to think about such a future where maybe right now we're benefiting from the fact that the world is not fair. Maybe it's good for us that the world is not fair. And someday the world will be fair, and then we have to really wonder, are we as deserving as we think we are? So that's a very scary kind of thing to focus on. And that's very powerful Musar. So says Rav Pam, so the brothers, they saw a glimpse of that. Because here, this little brat who they made fun of, who they sold into slavery, who was at the bottom of the totem pole, and they thought he was nothing. What happens? Ani Yosef, this guy, the king of Egypt, the vice king of Egypt, he's the little brat who we used to make fun of. So that's a glimpse of a future where Elyonim Lamata V'Tachtonim Lamala, where the whole social order, the way it is now, is flipped. And that's a very powerful Musar. That's something that's very scary, to think about how things could be the opposite of what they are in ways that don't necessarily work in our interest. It's a very scary thought. That's a very powerful Musar. So he quotes a Beis Halevi, which is a longer point, which we won't go into now, but there's a different Beis Halevi on this pasuk, where the Beis Halevi says a different Mahalach, which is also a very powerful point, and it's really an undeniable nekuda of human nature. If you think about what's going on here, right, so here Yehuda makes this whole plea to Yosef. He says, Yosef, have some rachmanis. I have an old father at home. He loves this son, Binyamin. It's going to be terrible for him. He's going to die. How could you be so cruel to take a favorite son away from this old father and put him through such emotional pain? To which Yosef responds, really? Really, are we so concerned about that? Well, guess what? Ani Yosef, remember me? I once upon a time was the same father's favorite son, and you weren't so worried about depriving him of my company. Was he able to survive that? How, Rabbi Chai, did he survive the time when you deprived him of his favorite son? So it's a very powerful point about how we, and you see this every day, all of us in our lives, that we argue what should be, how things should go, why we're right, the other guy's wrong, and we have blatant negias. We have these very glaring inconsistencies where our arguments are self-serving and we don't pick them up. And we don't realize that we're telling other people, oh, don't you see you should be this way, when we do the opposite. And this is an incredible example of it. It's really an undeniable point. If you think about it here, Yehuda's making this whole plea. How could you be such a cruel person to deprive Yaakov of his favorite little son? And he's not going to survive it. To which the response is, really? Okay, Ani Yosef, remember me? Ha'ora v'chai? Is that really so hard for him to endure? That's another pshat in this medrash. There's yet another pshat that Rav Shach was quoted as saying, that is also, again, this just comes one after another. They're all very deep insights into human nature, and they all come out of this medrash. That Rav Shach was quoted as saying as follows. We have an expression, din v'cheshbon, that loss of lava or kippur or whatever, we're going to have to come and give a din v'cheshbon. So there is a famous explanation attributed to the Vilna Gaon of what that phrase means, which is not what he's basing it on, but just parenthetically. The Vilna Gaon says it means you're going to have to give a din, you're going to have to pay the price, to get the punishment for the averus that you did. And the cheshbon, that reflects that you could have been doing good things with those energies or with that time. So you're both going to have to pay for the averus you did, and you're going to have to give an accounting for that which you didn't do because you were diverting that time and energy towards Averus. That's the expression, din v'cheshbon, according to him. But the Rav Shach quoted the pshat that it means something else, that the idea is, din v'cheshbon, you get paid back on two levels. That on the one hand, so you get punished for the Avera, but also every Avera is based on a bad cheshbon, is that you calculate that somehow it's going to be good for you if you do such and such. I think we had occasion to talk about this recently a little bit. maybe in the context of Geneva, about how well, we have to punish a ganav or an eid sheker in a way that undoes their whole cheshbon. So it's not just the avera that you pay for, but it's also the calculation that led you to do the avera that also is displayed as being false. So think about the story here again. Everything, all these vorts, they're mukhrach if you think about that. Right, so think about what's going on here. So why did the brothers do what they did to Yosef? Because they were afraid that he would become king over them. Right? He had these dreams that I'm going to be king and you're all going to come bow before me. So in order to fashter that, so they sold him into slavery. And what was the result? He's king over them. Right? The whole thing that they were trying to avoid. So here it is, it's happening. So not only did they do something wrong, but the whole cheshbon that they had in order to get to it, that was shown also to be completely counterproductive, that the nature of the Avera, not only is the Avera wrong, but whatever you're trying to accomplish through the Avera, so you end up accomplishing the opposite. You end up doing something completely counterproductive. There is a discussion about this in the Rashid of Karen B'Avner, of Goldach Sefer Asufas Marachos, where he says something similar, but a little bit different. And he says that here, the nature of the Tochacha, and the type of Tochacha that the Medrash talks about, L'asad Lavo, there's going to be a Tochacha, we're all going to have a hard time dealing with it. Says that there is a very powerful tochacha that people live their lives based on a certain premise. They take actions based on whatever beliefs they have. And if they're living lives that are not what they're supposed to be, it means the premise is wrong, but they just keep following the premise their entire life. And then, ultimately, if you become confronted with the fact that this premise is not true, so that's a tremendous embarrassment. That's just this, what Rashi then goes on to say over here, that they couldn't respond. Why couldn't they respond? So Rashi says over here, "Bipnei habusha," and that they couldn't say anything because they were so embarrassed. So the nature of the embarrassment in this context is that you get confronted with the fact that the premise you've been living on your whole life is a mistake. So not only is there tshuva to you, but there's just a deep humiliation. So here, they had Paskin that they believe he was a rodeh, if he deserves to die, because he's a faker, because he has these dreams of grandeur, these delusions which are not true. And we see that he was right. We see that it was true. So it's a slightly different from the pshat we just mentioned. It's not about the fact that they brought about that he should be the king, but the fact that it's revealed that he was correct, that his delusions of grandeur were not delusions. So therefore, it means the whole premise upon which they've been operating is taken out from under them. And that's a shocking idea. Rashiv went on to say there's also a medrash that compares this Musar of Yosef to the Musar of Bilam, that the brothers couldn't handle a tochacha from Yosef, and Bilam couldn't handle a tochacha from his donkey. So he says they're both the same idea, that we know that Bilam was, on one hand, a very accomplished spiritual figure, a great prophet, but in terms of his life, he lived a very vulgar and crass life. He lived a life of tremendous avera. So he apparently believed that you could totally bifurcate things, that you could have great spiritual insight, and that the physical world could be completely separate from that and not have any connection. So the idea that a donkey could talk, the idea that a Kadosh Baruch Hu could put expression of feelings in a donkey, which really chamor always represents, chomer always represents the most gashmius of gashmi, it's just not spiritual at all. You see, even that can be infused with spirituality, can be made to talk, can be made to have expression. So that was a refutation of Bilam's whole premise in life. So that's the same kind of idea, that there is a tochacha that says everything you've been assuming all along and living your life based on it is completely wrong. So that creates a deep, deep humiliation, this sense of everything having collapsed, and looking back and realizing, how could I have ever thought otherwise? So that's the type of busha that we're talking about here. And that's a very powerful force. Others, Reb Moshe Feinstein and Reb Simcha Zissel Broyd, in their comments on this pasuk, they focus specifically on that idea of the bnei habusha, of the fact that it is a tremendously motivating factor, that sometimes the desire not to sin is not so present. The concern for purity is not necessarily what motivates, but the desire to avoid busha, which is, again, the other half of what we were just talking about a minute ago in terms of Habanas Bnei Chaver Barabin. So we see that humiliation is able to accomplish what other things can't come close. So it can, chalila, drive somebody to suicide or death or something like that. but it also can motivate someone to avoid humiliation through not sitting, and it's a tremendously powerful force, more than any other motivation not to sin sometimes might be. So this focus on Pnei Habusha is relevant here as part of this as well. I'll just mention maybe one more idea here, and then maybe try to look quickly at Sheni Vayechi. So after humiliating them, or not humiliating them, but devastating them, after giving them this real knockout punch, so then he calms them down. He says, Yata al te'atzu al yichar b'neichem ki machartem o sihena ki lemichya shulachani elokim lefneichem. So don't feel so bad about it, that it all worked out well. This is an idea that comes up in the end of Vayechi a little bit more. I'll talk about it several years from now when we get there. But here, the idea is he's saying, don't feel so bad that it all turned out to be a life-sustaining thing, that you sold me here so that I could end up being here and keeping the world alive, so it all worked out well. So some of the Sfarim point out that he's addressing two different things, that he's worried that the brothers are going to be sad and upset at how things turned out, and they're also going to be angry at each other. Each one will now start trading blame. Oh, it's your fault we did this, it's your fault this happened, because of you, etc., etc. So he addresses both of them. Then this pasuk, he says, Kilamichya. He says that it worked out well, so don't worry about it. Don't be sad about how things happened, because it was for the best. And later on, he says, he emphasizes that Elohim worked it out, that it was all God's plan. So that addresses the second concern, that don't start sniping at each other, and don't start saying that it's your fault, it's your fault, it's none of your fault, it's all God's plan, and that's the way it is. Along similar lines, the Rishiva again of Kambi Abner of Goldacht in a different essay, so he talks about this whole idea, Kila Michya, and he says, so this notion that it was all for the best, so what are we saying? Are we saying that therefore the brothers, they were okay, they're allowed to do it because it was God's plan? Could Paro say the same thing, that it was okay? So the point is not so much to defend, but it's to make a fascinating point that because we're dealing here with the path of Klal Yisrael, with this whole winding journey that they took, it was all part of the Nevuah, and this is an idea that we saw a little bit when we were talking about the Parshas Vayesha, that there is kind of a overwhelming force that the human beings involved in the story don't seem to have the ability to resist. So to hear, he's saying this is God's plan, this is how the whole future of Klal Yisrael, whole destiny is being plotted out, and it was Kiyul, you didn't have Bechira Chavshis. It wasn't up to you to decide what was going to happen, that God was calling the shots. This is not a normal interaction between two people. This is the Torah. This is the future of Klal Yisrael and their path being plotted out here. So don't think anything different could have happened, and therefore you should recognize that as well. So just to very quickly look at the Sheni of Vayechi, which is also a very short aliyah, but it has some very significant things in it. So this involves Yaakov meeting his grandchildren and giving them the bracha. And he says to them just very quickly, so the grandchildren come to meet him, and he says, Ro fanecha lo filalti, I didn't think I would ever see you again. And Sid explains the language there, plila, is a way, it means to think about something, but it means the kind of thinking that comes through a lot of effort. You're really plotting, you're really thinking about something very carefully. And he was saying that even if I would try to devote a lot of effort to figure out a way to see you again, I don't think I could have come up with something. And yeah, here, Kadosh Baruch Hu worked it out, and here you are, here we're met all over again. So as we know, he switches his hands around, and he puts his right hand on Ephraim's head instead of on Menashe's head, and he reverses the order. He decides that the younger one should be the one who has the status of the Bechor. So it's an interesting question. First of all, so why does the Pasuk remind us that Menashe was the Bechor? Some of the commentaries suggest that was talking to the point, that he's seen the pattern here, that what looks to Yitzchak and Yishmael and Yaakov and Esav seems to always be that the chronological Bechor is not the one who is the leader. So maybe it's Davka because Menashe was the Bechor that he suspected that Ephraim should really be the one who's on top. But the Netziv also comments that for some purposes Menashe still was the Bechor. So why did he have to switch his hands around? He could have just had them stand in different order. He could have just put Ephraim on the right and put Menashe on the left, and he wouldn't have to do the fancy acrobatics with his hands. So apparently he was maintaining the order for some purposes, but not for others. So for spiritual purposes, Ephraim gets the right hand. Ephraim was Bechor in that sense. But for worldly matters, Menashe is still the oldest and still has that stature. So therefore, he stood in front, and it's recognized to that extent. And the pasuk goes on to say, "Vayivarach es Yosef," that he blesses Yosef. Really, this is the blessing of the sons of Yosef, and the Zohar and others explain that the blessing of the father comes from the blessing of the children, as any parent can tell you. That's the real bracha in life. So, V'yorech is Yosef v'yomer ha'elokim asher hishalchu avos ha'elofanav Avram v'yitzchak ha'elokim ha'roosi me'udi ha'yom hazeh. That the God who has walked, who has my fathers, Avram and Yitzchak, has walked in front of, he will protect you. So this idea of God having Avram and Yitzchak walking in front of him, so the Medrash gives two comparisons. One is to the Zakenim who walk in front of the Nasi, and the other is to the sheep who walk in front of the shepherd. And the Nitziv says they both have different meanings that are both relevant here. That the Zakenim walk in front of the Nasi, that's a kavod, that the Nasi comes in back and he has all the other lesser but still distinguished people walking in front of him. That's the way they express the kavod for the Nasi. So too, Avram and Yitzchak, they put themselves out there for the kavod of the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So it's like the Zakenim going in front of the Nasi. But also the imagery of the shepherd. The shepherd is behind the sheep are in front, but we know the shepherd is watching over the sheep, and he's really the one who's providing all the guidance and supervision. So too, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role here, that Avraham and Yitzchak are walking in front, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is watching. And Nitziv emphasizes the fact that Yaakov didn't include himself in this idea of walking in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu for his covet. It's interesting, the Ramban says the reason he left himself out is because he had to pull the shtick with Lavan, and that he didn't feel that it has the same, he had the same stature, that he was able to be listed with the same kind of yashrus, which is itself a fascinating statement. So in any event, we'll just read the last pasuk here, which is a very familiar pasuk, as we know, and we say Kriyat Shema Lamita, and we put our kids to sleep, so we know this last pasuk, which is a very mysterious pasuk. Hamalach ha-goa lo-simi kol-ra, yivarech asani ari, v'yikari v'hem shmi, v'shem avosai, avram v'yitzchak, v'yirgu la-rov, v'karev ha-aretz. So what's going on here? First of all, the Malach. So the Malach is going to bless you. So what does that mean? It says in the Tzid, points out, it means the Kadosh Baruch Hu, as already mentioned in the previous Pasuk. It says that God is the one who's watching. So sometimes he'll use the Malach, but this Pasuk, even though we say it in isolation and we sing it in isolation, but you really need the previous Pasuk to understand that this is God's Hashgacha, which he's doing through the intervention sometimes of a Malach. So who is HaMalach HaGoelosi? So the Lutzkirav discusses in Znayim Latorah that this is the Malach who was with Yaakov in Laban's house. That in Parak Lamed Beis, that aforementioned trick that he had to do, or a plan that he had to do on Laban, and the Malach reveals to him how it's working in Parshas Vayishlach. So that Malach is the same Malach who's going to watch out for you. Why? Because you need a Malach when you're in a setting of Gullus, and there are people who are going to be Gomo Ra Tachas Tova, people who you've been good to, who are then going to reverse fortunes on you, people like Lavan, people like Esav. So you're going to be in that position, Nashon Ephraim. You're the sons of Yosef who saved the whole nation, and yet you'll still find yourselves in Gullus, you'll still find yourselves needing protection. So that same Malach who was there for me at that time, he'll be for you in that context, and he will protect you. And then it ends off, Vayidgu Larov, Bekarev Haaretz, that Pasuk, Vayidgu Larov, has the notion of the Gemara interprets it to mean it's a reference to Puravu, that Madagim should be Yam Rabin, they're going to be a lot of children. So there's Nayan Latorah, so he makes a reference to the fact that he has an essay about this in his other sefer, Hadei about Yibur, that on the one hand, this is a simon of fertility and of having many descendants, but it's also a somewhat complex message that the idea of Dagim, so Dagim have many descendants, but they're also a great risk. There's so many forces that challenge them and that'll swallow them up, that many of them don't survive. But there's so many of them that the species survives because of their great fertility. So too, the Jewish people have tremendous challenges, but they're also going to have this bracha of Puravu that means they will ultimately survive despite all the challenges that come in front of them. But at the same time, the hope is that they won't have the challenges, that they'll both have the Puravu, but they'll also live lives of peace and harmony. So that's the end of the pasuk. Bekarev haaretz, ideally they should have the bracha of Vayidgu Larov, but it should be Bekarev haaretz. It shouldn't necessarily have to include this aspect of challenge that the fish are able to overcome. You shouldn't even have to overcome anything. The Gemara also has a comment, and we'll end with this, that the idea of Dagim Shabayam as the focus here is that the fish are covered up. You can't see them. They're under the sea. Some of the fish are very deep under the sea, and nobody sees them. They're in pitch black. So the fish are covered up, so it's a statement about avoiding the Ayin Hara, that the Gemara says the descendants of Yosef are saved from the Ayin Hara, and so too they're compared to the fish here, who are saved from Ayin Hara, that they're not people who others are going to see their great productivity and their great fertility and having so many descendants, and therefore they're not going to have the same kind of Ayin Hara, they're not going to have the same type of jealousy. So we discussed a little synergy, our discussion of Lo Sachmo, and we talked about whether there is an Indian of Lifnei Iver by Lo Sachmo, and in what ways could you possibly violate Lifnei Iver. So we discussed whether there's a technical concept of it or not. But we mentioned at the time that certainly in terms of provoking kinah, so we find many statements that we want to avoid, and that we have to take great measures to avoid provoking kinah, that not we shouldn't do things that are looking to attract other people's jealous attention, and that that can be a very destructive force, and that that's what we're being told here as well, that that's part of the bracha, that on the one hand you'll have a great success, but it should be like a dagam shabayam that are covered up, that it's not going to be done in a way that's going to evoke the Einhar. The Einhar is a, sounds like a mystical concept, but it also has a very rationalist way of understanding it also, that when you flaunt your success in public, so then people tend to want to knock you down, people tend to want to strike against it, so therefore you try to avoid provoking that type of negative eye, in a very literal sense. People should look at you with a mean look, with a jealous look. You don't want people doing that, so we try to avoid such type of provocation, and perhaps that is also the bracha that's contained in the Yirgul Arov, the Kerev Haaretz. All right, everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos. Again, Sunday, if you're watching, come to Kol Yom Rishon at 10:30, but we'll have normal